Welcome to the CFO Show. I'm your host, Melissa Howitson, CFO of Venice Solutions.
And I'm Tom Siegmiller, VP of FP&A at Venice Solutions. Today, we'll continue our series on business partnering, with our focus being on the office of the CTO.
Joining us for a conversation about building a strong relationship with your CTO is Joel Dolacy, CTO of WellSky. In his position, he has responsibility for both product development and information technology. All told, he has more than 20 years of experience. Joel, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here on your podcast. Looking forward to the discussion that we're going to have here.
Us too. And so to kick off, maybe we could have you do a little bit of an elevator pitch today on what the role of the CTO is from your perspective.
It's a good question. I think if you Google CTO, you'll find a lot of different roles and a lot of different responsibilities. And the way I look at it is primarily helping being a partner with the rest of the executive team there to really grow the business and grow this in a responsible manner that is fiscally responsible and that is matching what the need of our shareholders are, basically, because we are here to create shareholder value. So it really is around not just engineering or technology or whatnot. It's how can I put all of those capabilities to really increase revenue, do that in a manner that is allowing us to grow sustainably and having a company that has a long horizon in front of it.
It certainly comes with a lot of responsibility being the CTO and often has a bit of a broad mandate. When I think about CTO, often has product. You mentioned engineering, often IT. And each of those have a different responsibility, things they're trying to accomplish for the business. When you think about that and your prior experiences partnering with your finance teams, what does that look like in terms of what you're expecting from those finance partnerships? And do you have different expectations or priorities for those groups as they think about what they're looking to achieve with finance?
It's a great question. You know, as I mentioned, you know, for me, the role is to be a partner. And partner goes both ways. And in order to have a partnership that is successful, you need to have you need to give and you need to receive also. And so focusing there on that relationship with finance and the finance team in general, whether it's accounting or the budget team overall, is critical. Because at the end of the day, we're all here to generate, again, shareholder value, making sure that we are running companies that have are generating the outcomes that are wanted by those investors. And so it's critical at that level that there's an open channel of communication and collaboration between the two teams. We need to make sure that when we do investment, it's done with an eye on what is the outcome? What is that going to generate for the company? How are we going to generate value for the company? If we are spending money, are we spending the right amount of money? Are we spending too much money? Are we, you know, can we spend less money and be more effective and more efficient? You know, all those things are always things that aspects of the job that as a CTO, I have to figure out along with my finance partners there on the whole, where's the right level of investment? What is the right level of efficiency that we need to try to extract from the team right now at the time? You know, for the next 6 months, where do we need to make our investments? So, yeah, I think it's critical to have that relationship there with the finance team, because if you don't have that, first of all, you're flying blind and you cannot have really a growing business because you're missing the balance that is needed between the different kind of parts of the business.
I think it's so key you mentioned about, you know, potentially flying blind. And I think sometimes it's really easy for finance teams to assume that you see what we see. And we can take that for granted. And some of the most effective partnerships I've seen is where we make sure we take the time to share with the CTO, hey, here's what I'm seeing. If it's, you know, working with IT and software spend across the org, I'm wondering about this and this, or here's what I've had when I'm speaking with your leaders. Does this match your expectation? And then you often provide a lot of context that we are missing. And together we start to get a better holistic picture. So I think it's really critical that, you know, we're working across with your leadership, but also upwards with yourself in terms of connecting these dots and making sure we do together have that whole picture.
Joelle, it's always a pleasure to partner with an organization that's trying to act in a fiscally responsible fashion. You sort of stated that as one of your mandates as the CTO. You talked a lot about instances where you're concerned about spending too much. I think one of the things that we always have to focus on in finance is not just fixating on where are we spending too much, but are there areas where we're spending too little, opportunities that aren't being really mined to the extent that they can be? And so as we think about the partnership between the CTO and the Office of Finance, are there areas where finance teams should be looking to improve their skill set? Is there sort of a challenge that constantly manifests itself as you work with finance teams that we could work better on?
Yes, certainly. I think that historically, you know, finance has always felt very comfortable with a project view of the world. You know, things start, you spend money, things finish. And I think overall, you see the evolution though with, you know, from project to product mindset. And how do you build lasting companies that basically have products that basically span multiple year, and basically investments on that product need to go on until the last client is of that product, which sometimes can take 10, 15, 20 years. Sometimes we don't know when we start those journey. And so I would say that that's probably the biggest kind of shift that can help finance is to take a look at, you know, project makes sense for planning in the super short term. You can think about, okay, we're going to build this feature. It's a project and we're going to build that as part of a product. So there's a continuity after that. There's going to be maintenance needed for that feature overall and whatnot, or even improvement on that feature. And so I would say, if you keep in mind that concept that there is a continuum basically in that product and that it's going to require investment, I think that's where I see often, you know, the biggest disconnect there is that there tends to be a very project approach to, you know, budgeting and other activities there. And sometimes taking a step back and for us also doing a better job as technologists there to really kind of bring that back into the lens and the part of the discussion there that, look, this is a product. And there's going to be continuous investment at that level is critical there. And I think that's where I think there's still more work to be done. I'm not sure that we have cracked the code completely on doing that. I think it's easy when you read those books or you listen to those speakers about, oh, you know, it's project to product. And a lot of them have grown up into like big tech companies like the Googles and Microsofts of the world that basically have always taken that view of product versus project. I think the companies that are not those big tech giants still have more work to do to get there. And the executives that are basically part of those teams have more work to do.
Melissa, it's funny. We always talk about rolling forecasts versus just having an annual budget. And I see a lot of similarities there where, you know, if a company doesn't have a rolling forecast, and Joelle, just for you, you know, we talk about the world doesn't end at the end of a fiscal year. You don't hit December 31st, fall off a cliff, and then nothing happens after that. And I think we think about it in terms of forecasting and budgets, but clearly parallels here when we talk about a project versus a product. It doesn't fall off the cliff after ultimately that project is done.
Yeah, that rings so true with, you know, hiring, for instance. You know, we have budgets associated with fiscal years, and then come the next first day of the next fiscal year, and everybody hopes that they're going to get all of their resources starting on that first day or that first month. And you know, we have to do a better job there on our side to make sure that the expectations are set with the teams that it's on over a 12-month window that's going to happen. And I still see a lot of leaders there, you know, always putting their hopes that, oh, the first week of the next fiscal year is going to solve all of our problems. So I like the fact that of the concept of a rolling, you know, kind of rolling forecast, it makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely. We're big fans of that for sure. You need a business to, you don't want to be thrashing a business over fiscal years and budget cycles. You want to have a smooth continuation of here's what we're trying to accomplish over time. You talked about that product versus project and the ongoing product. What I have found sometimes happens is that starts to go into this big bucket called maintenance. And that starts to feel like a bit of a black hole when you're in finance. And I've also heard different leaders within the CTO office suggest that it's as much deciding what you're going to continue doing as much as deciding what you're going to stop continuing doing as well, and knowing when it's maybe time to end a product or stop that investment and move that investment. How have you seen that play out, or thoughts about, you know, tips for finance people and how to work with you and identifying that ongoing nature, but also where do we stop putting money and you know, make those hard decisions to redirect funds?
Yeah, that's a, you know, challenging problem overall for a lot of leaders across the board, is what is the right level of maintenance for a product? There's no hard and fast rule, because it depends on so many factors. Have you inherited that? Is it technology that is 15, 20 years old that needs to be up-leveled? Is it brand new things, you know, that you just put on the market but needs some, you know, care and feed at that level? But I think there's a misconception that, you know, software is written once and it's cast in stone. And that may be true for, you know, things that fly in the air, like, you know, rocket ships and planes, and where the cost of making a mistake there is really, really high. And there's a lot of, you know, regulations behind it. But I would say for the vast majority of what I would call commercial software, the level of quality that you can build as part of your development process is not at the level that you will have for a potential, you know, kind of life-threatening, you know, kind of a system. And so knowing that, you know that there is going to be a maintenance cost associated with any type of software that you're writing. There's been studies after studies over the past 30 years now of software that, you know, it's software entropy is something. And it basically is just that as you add more features on top of an existing system, it makes that system more complex, which means that maintaining it gets more complex. And things that used to take a week, if you don't plan for it to keep staying a week going forward, will soon become a month or 2 months or 3 months and slow down your velocity. And so at that level, if you don't do those investments and if you don't plan for maintenance along the way, it's just like you trying to drive your car and not taking any type of the intermediary maintenance. And sure, you can probably, you know, kind of, you can probably skip a few oil maintenance, but I guarantee you're not going to make 100,000 miles out of your car if you're skipping all of your oil changes, you know, there. And so I think it's a little bit the same thing. It feels like, oh, you know, we could skip this and that. And I think the fallacy there is that there are a lot of engineering teams, technology team that always want to please. And they always try to say, they don't want to be the ones that say no. And so, yes, can you go without doing this maintenance today? Well, the answer is probably yes. I think what is often left out of the discussion is, what is the long-term ramification of that? And that's so difficult to evaluate because a lot of it's subjective. And in the heat of the moment, I would say the teams and teammates typically don't necessarily spend the amount of time explaining the risk for the business of us not doing that. And I think that's where you look at, you know, again, going back to the big tech players, they spend a huge amount of time maintaining the stuff that they put in production. It is a thing. And there's a reason why they do that. It's because their time horizon is, you know, when Google puts something on production, they know it has a lifespan of 5 to 10 years. And they put a huge amount of, you know, kind of time and effort making sure that the maintenance aspect of that is taken care of. I would say that's the difference to some extent between software engineering and just doing pure development. If you're hiring just developers, you're just slapping stuff in production and not thinking about tomorrow. So that's kind of where I kind of put the difference there and the need for maintenance overall.
I think that's super helpful for finance folks as we're thinking about those budgets. And even when I think about how we're sometimes possibly the catalyst behind, you know, skipping the oil changes, which can catch up over time. So thank you for that. Now, when you think about some of the strongest CFOs or finance business partners that you've worked with, what would be some of the attributes that you've seen?
Typically, it's openness and leaning in and really kind of, you know, going in and wanting to make, you know, the technology branch as good as it can be through their capabilities. And by capabilities, I mean, again, educating us around the challenges that can loom from a financial perspective if we do the wrong thing on the engineering side. Or, for instance, you know, in the past, a lot of our engineering teams and technology organization understood the rules of revenue recognition. And those were complex for on-premise software, But the benefit of that, it aligned everyone to really make sure that they understood that we had to remove all the friction that could come up and change the way revenue was recognized or delay the way revenue could be recognized. And so at that level of knowledge from engineers to really understand what the challenge were was key for us to be able to execute and really shape how the organization was delivering software. And so I think that's the key lesson there is, you know, I think engineers and technology people, we are creative people. We are trying to solve problems. And so the more you can come with, hey, here's the problem we have to solve and not necessarily the constraints about, hey, here's how I'm going to want you to solve this problem, but work together at that level with one another about what is the best solution for the company on how to solve this problem. I think that's where I've seen the most success, basically, and also the most buy-in from the engineers and the technology organization and the product organization to really make sure that people were really, you know, kind of took at heart to ensure the success there of the financial partners that they were dealing with.
Great advice. And where have you, on flipping the script then on that, where's been an example of behaviors or where you've seen tension be created between finance and CTO?
I think it often comes down to breakdown in communication and assumptions. Overall, that's usually the root of all evil is at that level, is the fact that you have an assumption, the other side has an assumption. Guess what? Those assumptions are not the same assumptions, and you end up with a gap at that level. And so sometimes it's been generated by, you know, my side that basically was overly optimistic around things and didn't have the right controls in place and whatnot. Sometimes it has happened on the finance side by them not necessarily having all of the key elements or having things that drop to the cracks out there in some of their process. And in the end, where we solve that is by communicating a lot closer and ensuring that we identify the cracks on both sides and really kind of, you know, working together to figure out what was the best approach to actually kind of solve those and bridge those gaps.
The secret sauce really does seem to be being open and curious as to each other's worlds and roles. And so as you talked about finance working with the CTO org to educate them, one of the things that we're so lucky to have in the finance organization and in a business partnering role is the ability to go out to organizations that will hopefully teach us and educate us about their worlds and what they're challenging and experiencing. And I think the way you shape the don't dictate a solution, share with us the problem or the challenge. And I think to the extent that in any business partnering relationship, both parties step up and ultimately seek to understand the perspective and the construct of the challenge, I think you're absolutely correct. That's like a recipe for creating a phenomenal solution for the organization. And so as we think about the relationships that you fostered over time with your finance department, can you think of an example where through having a really well-built relationship with finance, you've driven a significantly better outcome than if that relationship hadn't been fostered in advance of you tackling a challenge or an opportunity that presented itself within the organization?
Yeah, for sure. Yes, there's certainly kind of two areas that come to mind here. You know, the first one is we are doing a big cloud transformation and moving to public cloud. And so, you know, really kind of having the right level of visibility in terms of our spend, the ramp, the predictability of what the burn rate to some extent of or usage rate of those cloud resources was critical. And so we partnered pretty closely there with finance to make sure that we had and they had the same visibility as we had with our tools around the usage and the, you know, kind of the forecasting aspect also from a budget perspective. And I would say it's still a work in progress, but if I look at where we are now compared to where we were 18 months ago, this is night and day. And I think the other one is you know, taking a step back from that is around the budgeting to some extent. And we use a lot of, you know, contractor vendors as part of our overall development organization, in addition to our, you know, full-time employees. And so dealing with the predictability of all of the SOWs and contracts and all of that has required us to work a lot closer with our finance team there and really work, you know, in close collaboration with them so that we have the right treatment from an accounting perspective of some of those contracts that we have with vendors, because some of them are treated differently from a run rate to, you know, what we call surge and surge funding, basically, which are, you know, kind of ways for us to accelerate some initiatives there without necessarily hitting the bottom line. And so making sure that the proper allocation, the proper organization and track and keeping track of all of those contracts and who's working on what. And are we sure that those things are aligned and the way they are? And does this match the actuals that we are getting on the, you know, with the delay there? Does that match? So all of that, we've had to gone through multiple cycles there of collaboration with finance and really trying to get to a picture that is, you know, getting to a converging to really kind of from or bottoms up to the top down that is driven by finance and making sure that the delta there is really something that we all feel comfortable with versus some of the, you know, I would say surprises that we've had in the past and surprise usually have a bad connotation, not good ones. So, you know, it is still a work in progress. But again, if I look at where we have been compared to where we are now, just huge amount of progress. And it comes down to just making sure that we relentlessly go and try to identify the gaps and then how do we solve them, you know, on both sides.
The CFO Show is brought to you by Vena, the intelligent platform for complete planning. Vena's award-winning platform makes financial and operational planning more efficient, unlocks performance, and increases financial intelligence across the business so finance teams and business leaders can plan for anything. Learn more at venasolutions.com.
You're bringing me back flashbacks, actually. You mentioned that example of the move to public cloud, and I've lived through that transition before. And there were certainly two things I think I learned in that situation, and especially when it comes to fostering this relationship between finance and CTO. One was that need for there to be trust, because you can be embarking on a big, scary project with unknowns. And I remember at times when we'd find surprises and the natural reaction of finance was, well, how did we not know this? Or you can jump into negative thinking and fear can set in of, okay, how big is this going to be? What's that going to cost? What's this going to mean? Should we pull the plug? You can start to go there. And I think that what I learned in the process is you have to expect there will be unknowns. You have to create that environment where it's okay to share things as you're learning them in real time and not overreact to them, so that together you can put your heads together to solve, to find a path through, whether it's reset, expectations, timelines, whatever. But it takes meeting in the middle and holding back even some of what might be our natural reactions to things to create that relationship of trust. The other thing is, I realized in that particular example, maybe there were skill sets missing in my own team where we were going to need to learn, how do you cost for the cloud? What are the nuances? As much as we had somebody on the technical side learning how to understand how that was going to work, we in finance really needed to upskill our own knowledge there. And so, you know, I think there are examples there where partnering, coming together and figuring out how you both maybe need to do things differently makes a huge difference and is critical to that success to get you to the other side of the project. Now, as we think about helping finance teams understand what are some of those things that are top of mind, can you maybe share what are some of those top challenges that as CTO you're facing that we should know about?
Mileage will vary depending on who and what responsibilities your CTO has. From my perspective, you know, what's top of mind right now is cybersecurity overall, is how do I make sure that, you know, we protect the business and we still end up with a business, you know, tomorrow, you know, a week from now, a month from now, 6 months from now, 12 months from now. And so that is really top of mind. The other one is also around, how do we manage the team and how do I ensure that I have the right team there to actually focus on solving the problem, not only that we've had yesterday, but the problems that we have today and the ones that we're going to have tomorrow, knowing that the expectation is that we are supposed to be able to do things faster than we've done them before, you know, given the tooling, given the pressure from competitors that are there and whatnot. So there is always this kind of wheel that is going about the innovation progress that is pushing us to find the next level of productivity, the next level of efficiency, and where do we apply that? So that's another big one. And then the third one is, as I said, we are in a big cloud migration. And so, you know, we have a lot of migration project going on. And so the next step now for us is, okay, so now that we are past at least the 50% mark there on the migration, how do we tackle the last mile of those? But then also, how do we start taking advantage of the capabilities that those cloud environments are providing us? Do we, you know, whether it's from a client experience perspective with DR environments and high availability environments, but also in terms of innovation, how can we co-innovate there with our, you know, cloud vendor partner there to really just accelerate some of the capabilities that we need to have in our products so that we can actually solve some of the problems in a really different manner than we would have thought about, you know, even 12 months, 24 months ago. And that goes along with, you know, Gen AI type of capabilities and whatnot that are really coming online. And how do we take advantage of those as part of, you know, those cloud, you know, kind of partnerships? That is kind of key right now for me is how do we accelerate, you know, the product development that we have and the feature capabilities that we have in our products to really kind of take a step function instead of just taking, you know, I would say linear, you know, improvement over time.
Joelle, you talked a little bit about the challenges of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. One of the challenges we always have in finance is understanding getting that right mix of investment and product between the short, mid, and long-term horizons. How do you think about tackling that problem?
I think it goes a little bit back to the question around maintenance, and it's a slightly different view of that. You know, there's, I don't know who came up with this, McKinsey probably, with the three horizon, you know, framework there, with horizon one being your current business and what is generating revenue. No, horizon two being, you know, what's in the pipeline, but, you know, it's past the incubation. So to some extent, you have product market fit, but no, you have to put some gasoline on that to really kind of grow it and for it to become your next source of revenue. And then you've got horizon three, which is purely speculative and really looking at, okay, what is going to be your revenue generating opportunities 2 years, 3 years down the line, basically. So I think it's still a relevant framework overall. I think that what I've seen in practice where companies tend to, you know, really kind of struggle is a little bit about figuring out when you actually need to stop investing in some of your existing products. And when do you make the switch to, I'm going to put a lot of, you know, capabilities now on some of my Horizon 2 investments so that I can make them become Horizon 1. But it really is this, you know, kind of figure out the point in time when you take that decision. And so from that perspective, what I've seen is if we go into that conversation just purely from a technology or support perspective, you have very little chance of actually getting out of that conversation very successfully, because the question will always be, but this is generating $1 million or $2 million or X million of dollar of revenue with very little work needed to be done. What's going to take place of that? And what's missing into that discussion is, what is the revenue that should be coming out from your Horizon 2 investment? And so that's what the discussion needs to be, is you need to have the confidence there that the work that you have funded to actually get to that point in Horizon 2 has a way for exploding and really kind of get to revenue accelerated velocity there of growth. And at that point, you can have the conversation about, it's time for us to EOL, you know, end of lifing those two product lines here, because, you know, they've been around for X amount of years. And yes, they've been very profitable for us. But the reality is that that's not where the ball is going right now. And we need to really kind of bring those new capabilities here. And in order for us to do that, we need to actually be able to take some of the money that is still entrenched in maintaining some of those old solutions because they're never for free. They never are. It's very difficult to track exactly how much money you spent on them because it's so kind of infrequent and ad hoc work. So that's the way I think about it. So I think you have to figure out for your company, and I would say the company that, you know, by that I mean, are you VC backed? Are you PE backed? Where are you in your whole period and whatnot? I think that's going to define and help you determine what amount of investment do we need to allocate for Horizon 1. And then Horizon 2, what is the amount of money that we believe that we need to generate, that we need to allocate there? And in Horizon 3, you probably always need to have something there looking forward, but that's probably the most difficult one to actually kind of fund, especially for smaller companies, because, you know, typically they already are strapped to look at just what's coming now. Horizon 2 is already a stretch, and then Horizon 3, it's really kind of, well, we'll get at that whenever we have time. And I think that's where sometimes things get sideways.
Yeah, I love how you're suggesting, you know, stepping back and taking a look at that picture. There's not one size that fits all. It really is a different mix that is going to make sense for where you are in the company. But being mindful of it, reflecting, and sometimes it's all about trades, right? At the end of the day, you're just making trades between the different options that you have. But you certainly don't want to lose sight of that Horizon 3 as well, which can sometimes happen, especially we talked earlier about that focus on the next fiscal year or the next 18 months. Well, those longer term bets may not be played. And if you don't make them ever, that can be quite detrimental for a business as well. So thank you so much for that. Now, when I think about some of the things that sort of keep us up at night in finance or stress us out when we think about the investments that we make in this side of the business, I think one of the issues that we face is that some other investments are much easier in terms of the ability to measure what the outcome is. I think about sales and marketing investments. We think, okay, what's the productivity per rep? What's my cost of acquiring a customer? How long are they going to stay with me? It's easier math and simpler to measure. Should I be investing or shouldn't I? But it's a lot more challenging when we think about those R&D investments because there is more gray area, things that are not as known. But one of the topics that often comes up is we have to think about, well, what's the ROI going to be on that investment? What do we think it's going to be? Similarly, what is this productivity or output of our engineering team going to look like? And how are we measuring that productivity? And so I'd love to know your thoughts, Joelle, on how do you think about those things? Because I'm sure you get those questions as well. I sit there often with my CTO facing those questions together. What are some thoughts?
Yeah, for sure. Those are questions that come very often. And I think they started coming more often probably 4 or 5 years ago where, you know, I think there was a lot more, you know, question around that. But if you look at, I mean, I think it's been the past 30 years or pretty much since software was starting to be incorporated part of the business that business leaders have been asked, hey, how do we evaluate the productivity of engineers? And there's been a lot of different attempts to get there, you know, calculating the number of lines of code that an engineer is supposed to write every day and whatnot. And the challenge with those is that, as you mentioned, they're focused on output. So a bit like, you know, if you're tracking the number of phone calls that one of our sales rep is actually doing on a day or supposed to be doing in a week, that doesn't necessarily kind of tie to an outcome. I think there's a proxy sometimes that leads to, well, we know by experience that if they make so many phone calls per day that they will lead to a certain number of conversions and whatnot. The problem is in software, that doesn't really work that way. I mean, if I'm putting a mandate that everybody's got to write 200 lines of code every day, I'm going to get that metric. I can guarantee you all developers will write their 200 and we're going to have a lot of overachievers also. Some of them will write 300. The challenge is that that is not equating to the outcome that you want as a business. It doesn't guarantee that you're going to have the product that your clients want. It doesn't mean that the features that you're putting on the market are going to be the ones that your clients and customers and users really want to use. And so with all that said, we still need to continue to try to you know, track what engineering productivity looks like. There is a need for us to try to understand how to get better. And at that level, it means that the only way to do that is you have to measure aspects of the work being done. And some of that will be some outputs. Some of that will try to be some outcomes, you know, by leveraging, you know, maybe products like Pendo and others that are giving you insights on how your users are actually using your software and how you can tie that back then to revenue and whatnot. But there are things that, you know, you can look at that usually come in not just as standalone metrics, but they typically come in a bunch, because just one on its own, you can trick it. Like you could say, well, we want to ship software all the time. So we want to be able to deploy multiple times a day. And if I do that as a metric, the challenge with that is I can end up with just a lot of quality issues, because I could just push a lot of deployments and not having the right quality. So now you have, okay, but I want to make sure that my number of failures, for instance, for each deployment is below a certain threshold. And then after that, you're looking also, okay, so in terms of flow time, how long does it take when my engineering team are getting their hands on the requirements? How long does it take them for implementing the work that they are doing and going to production? And so, you know, so there are metrics that you can use there. I think the message there is you have to spend the time within your business to try to figure out how does that match to the business that I'm in? What is the right answer that we are trying to set for our clients and for success? And then from there, let's backtrack and try to identify, are there signals that we can see in those metrics that would tell us whether we are making the right progress or not? Trying to find the one metric that's going to tell you whether you have your engineering productivity in hand or not is really dangerous, because so far I've not seen yet a metric that can be used that can't be tricked either. And that's the challenge, because if you use those metrics purely from trying to get better, typically you've got a really, I mean, you can have a good rate of success. Where things get sideways is once those metrics starts to make their way into, you know, annual performance evaluation for engineers and whatnot. That is where typically those engineers will start to play the game and say, oh, wait a second, I'm going to be evaluated on this metric. So I'm going to make that metric look good. And that's where the company lose overall, because they don't get the outcome that the metric is supposed to imply. They get the outcome of, well, I'm going to play the metric because now I'm evaluated that. And by the way, my raise or my evaluation at the end of the year is going to be based on that metric. So there's a lot of work going on right now. McKinsey just came out with, you know, an article there about it's possible for you to, you know, measure and, you know, engineering productivity. And there's some good points that they have in there. But again, it is not something that is fully baked at this point. And I just don't see how it can be fully baked, because it is so dependent from each business. They need to make their own decisions about what success looks like. And also, I think the last part of that is you need to make your engineering leaders there, first of all, trust them that they have the right capability to evaluate their engineering teams. And if you don't feel that, then, you know, you need to change them. And then the other part of that is they have to do the job of understanding that, are they pushing their team to pass what their limits are to some extent? You know, are they pushing them beyond what their limits can be, and really kind of getting to a place there where you are getting the right level of innovation from a you know, kind of software development perspective? And I think that's where the managers and leaders that are in engineering have still a really big impact and a big role to play, and the CTO has a big role to play. Because at the end, that's why you hire them. They are supposed to be the specialist on how to build software. And so at that level, your job is, I think, going to be more successful if you explain why you want to understand the productivity. You know, if it's just to actually, well, we want to reduce investment or whatnot, that probably won't go well. But for us to get better and to improve, you know, our capabilities, improve our client success, improve our client satisfaction, understanding where we need to put the investments and whatnot, I think those are conversations that a lot of engineering leader can have and won't be defensive.
And so on a day-to-day basis, Joelle, we're always seeking to become better business partners. I know that's something that I wake up every day and think, I'd like to get better in this particular realm. To wrap up for our audience, if there was one thing that you think finance teams typically don't have right or know about the CTO org, what would that one thing be?
what I see in software, what gets you is always the assumptions. And, you know, it's assuming that something is working this way and it's actually not. And I think it's the same thing there. It's misconception. Just like I can be overly reductive if I'm thinking about how marketing works or how finance work or how, you know, what not my specialty is. And I think that when you do that, it's a little bit like doing, you know, armchair quarterback on Monday morning, you know, where you think that you know how people should do their job better. And the reality is, I think that you have to give them the benefit of the doubt, just like I give the benefit of the doubt to them because I know that they're dealing with problems that I have no clue how to deal with them. And it's a lot more complex than just running, you know, a set of additions and subtraction, basically, by, you know, to try to get to a financial statement. And I think it's a little bit the same there, I would say, is just, you know, open your aperture a little bit. It's more than just writing code, having hands on keyboards and trying to get things done. Yeah, that's part of the job, but there's a lot of the job that is also about thinking what the right solution is so that you can actually minimize the amount of lines of code that you have to write. And unfortunately, that is the hardest part because it's very subjective, but that is part of software development. That is part of software engineering.
Such amazing advice. Thank you so much, Joel. Really appreciate that. Armchair quarterback. It's much easier to be that armchair quarterback, isn't it? Definitely makes me pause and think. Now, whenever we have a guest on the show, we like to give them two rapid fire questions. So are you ready?
Sure.
All right. First one, what is the best piece of business or leadership advice that you've ever received?
Clients don't buy technology, clients buy solutions. And technology is a big part of making that solution. But at the end of the day, how new your technology is or whatnot doesn't matter. What really matters is what you're solving, the problem that you're solving. And you can solve some of those with really old technology and still make your clients happy.
Excellent piece of advice. The next one is, what is something that you do in your personal life that helps you show up as your best self in your work life?
I try to stay always up to speed on technology and curious, basically. I think that's what it is. I try to stay curious around a lot of things, and that helps me as part of my role in technology. You know, it is an ever-changing landscape. And so whether it's staying curious about, you know, things around cooking or cooking techniques or you know, things related to that, to technology, all of that stuff is incredibly kind of related to some extent. So I think it's more about the mindset there.
Valuable advice. Thank you so much for sharing. I know I speak for both myself and Tom when I say we've learned a lot from this. Always love to learn how we can be better business partners with the different parts of the business. And so really appreciate you joining us on the show today.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you, Tom.
Melissa, what an awesome conversation with Joel, right?
Oh my goodness. He was so engaging and he had so many great nuggets for us. I was taking notes in my head the whole time.
You know what? I was too. And I thought maybe for this episode, we could do a bit of a recap. What are one to two items that really stuck with us as we went through the conversation?
What a great idea. I'll go first. I think the one that really resonated for me was when he talked about the oil changes and skipping those, but over time that catches up with you. And I think about our role in that in finance, how often we may actually be the catalyst for the business skipping those oil changes. We have to be really cognizant of that.
Not only that within the business, but also within our own function. How often do we skip our own oil changes and just try to keep pushing forward and forward within the org? For me, my one big takeaway was, let's not make assumptions. Let's not assume we know something and have a miscommunication. Keep the lines of communication open, be curious, be engaged, be interested. That's probably the key to being a wonderful business partner.
Absolutely. You want to make sure that you understand where they're coming from and you really have that whole picture, because we assume that we know it all or we have a decision made on what we see, but we might be missing part of the picture. We may not have walked a mile in the shoes of the other person. And so really key to come together and communicate. Couldn't agree more. So that's it for today's episode. And Tom, thank you so much for joining me today. If you'd like more information about today's show, please see the links in the show notes. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to or watch your podcast, because you don't want to miss an upcoming episode. For the CFO Show, I'm Melissa Howitson. Until next time.